Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every Monday to Friday from 11 to noon. You can reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or you can download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how are you today?
I'm well. I have a little bit of trivia, not fast food trivia, but fast trivia about food.
Fast trivia food, okay.
I'm ready. Here we go. This year it seems that pumpkins are going to be more expensive, the crop reports are in, and we had the worst summer on record from since 95.
I always found it fascinating when learning that a lot of the pumpkins in the pumpkin patches that here in New Jersey are imported pumpkins, that they don't actually grow in the patch in which you pick them.
Well, and what they say, what's funny is some places are more upfront about it than others, but what they do is they go out and they go into the pumpkin patch, which sometimes isn't even a pumpkin patch, but often it'll be a pumpkin patch with a pumpkin vine, and when you go out to that pumpkin, the pumpkins are never attached to the vine. Because, in fairness, the pumpkin is attached through a very, I mean, the pumpkin's a big thing, so it's actually a very tough piece of branch there to the vine.
Think machete.
So they need to cut that pumpkin off the vine, and so they do that the first time. So when you go out there, your pumpkin has already been cut from the vine, and it's supposedly left standing there. Except, did you ever wonder what happens when you see a relatively meager pumpkin patch full of pumpkins, and then everybody goes and picks the pumpkins at the end of the day?
And then the next day, there's more pumpkins again.
Do you think they have those overnight pumpkins that grow very quickly?
It's the great pumpkin. I saw Linus and Charlie Brown.
What they do is they take these pumpkins that they get from Illinois, and they walk them out into the pumpkin patch and put them down next to the old vines that have been cut from the prior
pumpkins.
You
know what? I don't mind. You bring the kids in. It's a little Santa Claus lore for them to enjoy.
I have to say, who cares? I'm going to cut it up and put a candle in it.
Can I tell you the latest, greatest thing, and you don't have kids, so you don't know this?
Uh-huh.
When you go to these pumpkin patches, they have the corn maze. They have all these other things. Well, in the last few years, they've started for the little pumpkins that they don't sell very much of, or the slightly rotting pumpkins. Basically, it's a giant slingshot with the pumpkins.
I like that.
They charge you like a buck at these little pumpkin patches, and you get to fire this giant slingshot at a target or some kind of board or something like that. Very amusing.
I'm in favor. I'm in favor.
What I will tell you, not very accurate. This is not a way we want to protect ourselves in case of
Homeland Security does not need to be notified about this. I have to say, I took 1 year, and you know me, I'm all about buying locally, and I'm all about experimenting with making foods from scratch, and I'm all about ice cream from scratch and all that stuff in my home and in our business, of course. I made pumpkin pie from pumpkins once.
Yeah.
By the can stuff. Okay. And there are two reasons I say that. One, it took me forever to scrape out a pumpkin to get the pumpkin meat to make a pumpkin pie.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, after all this work, after all this labor, simply no difference between that and a canned pumpkin pie. I was like, all right, well, I worked all day on this. This is a real pumpkin pie. Just the same as if I'd made it with a can of whatever the canned pumpkin stuff is.
So I'll tell you another silly fact about pumpkins.
You're just a plethora of pumpkin knowledge.
You know, when my daughter was first born 10 years ago, we planted pumpkin seeds.
Uh-huh.
So to grow our own pumpkins.
Uh-huh.
So we planted a couple pumpkin seeds, and I learned something.
What'd you learn?
That you can't grow pumpkins from just a couple of seeds from the same pumpkin.
Well, how do you do it?
You plant them and it will grow vines, but you need enough pumpkins in your pumpkin patch for your pumpkins, for your pumpkin flowers to cross pollinate, or you won't ever get any pumpkins. You will get a really, really long, tangly pumpkin vine, but you'll never get pumpkins.
So you need pumpkin vines and bees.
You need pumpkin vines and bees, exactly. Mm. Your pumpkins need to cross pollinate, or you will never. Your pumpkin flowers need to cross pollinate, or you will never get pumpkins.
Okay, well, in the spirit of Francis and Mark can talk about anything food related for a long, long time, let's turn the conversation.
We were going to talk about pumpkins for 18 seconds.
Yeah,
here.
This was the fast. I had like 9 more things to talk about, but let's turn the conversation, of course, where it leads us is to We were one of the first people in the country to bring in regularly to import pumpkin seed oil.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds bizarre, right? Pumpkin seed oil from Austria, and not just from Austria. In the south of Austria, a province of Austria is called Styria, and that was traditionally the breadbasket of Austria. That was where the farming all came from in Austria. And one of the things that they make in Styria, and pretty much only in Styria, I mean, there are a few people that make it not well in other parts of the world now, is an oil from the seed of certain pumpkins that are indigenous to Styria, and only Styria. And these pumpkins they have down there, the meat of the pumpkin is inedible.
Mm-hmm.
They grow these pumpkins for the seeds, and not to eat the seeds, but to make oil from the seeds. Cheap stuff.
And this is one of those magic bullets that, you know, if you're a novice chef, if you're a cook at home, that you, if you have in your pantry and you pull out and you use just the right way, you'll just surprise and amaze your friends. But it's also a magic bullet for chefs, for professional chefs. If you haven't used Syrian pumpkin seed oil in your cooking, you're missing out. One of my favorite applications of all time, we've done a couple of different things with the Syrian pumpkin seed oil, obviously, over the years. We've had it in the restaurant for almost 10 years now. But one of my favorite applications of all time,
I know what you're going to say,
was the ice cream.
Yeah, we made ice cream from
my
pumpkin
goodness.
Seed oil.
It was so
We're going to do it again
this season.
All right, good. But Austrian roasted pumpkin seed oil, you can now there it's more widely available on the market. We used to sneak it in our suitcases mm-hmm. when we'd come back from Austria, but now it's
and if anybody was coming from Austria, like 4 bottles of pumpkin seed
oil. Yeah, exactly. But now it's brought in through the country through Austrian wine importer Terry Fies.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can't just get a bottle from him, a single bottle. You can go to a specialty food store and look it up. Or you can email us, and we'll either sell you some ourselves or tell you how to get a bottle.
Should I think some specialty stores like Dina DeLuca and places like that. And
should be able to small bottle, especially $15-$20.
Now, yeah, maybe a little more.
Now, in Austria, it's pretty much used on salad. That's pretty much how it's used. However, it has an amazing variety of applications. It's a very low-acid oil and a mm-hmm. very flavorful oil. It's this green. It's this verdant green color. We've used it to make ice cream. We've used it in all sorts of savory applications and sweet applications.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do, it actually works well with anything that's being made with pumpkins or squash. It really brightens up the flavor. It is fairly expensive. It is fairly perishable. You should use it within 6-7 months of opening the bottle.
But it's magical. I'm telling you, it does perish, so you can't keep it forever. But it's one of those magical things, just a few drops. Think of it like almost like you would think of one of those really old aged balsamic vinegars.
And there are different quality levels. So when you see the more expensive ones, they're usually worth it because the best Austrian pumpkin seed oils are made by hand because the machines strip out some of the quality from the pumpkin seeds. So they're made by hand. They take these pumpkin seeds, they press them very gently in a warm vat by the machine. It's
a fascinating process.
And you watch it come off the mill, and it is absolutely amazing. I've been in Austria. I've been lucky enough to be invited to some folks where they were making the pumpkin seed oil and
I just think it's great that you have a product where you don't grow it for the fruit, you actually grow it for the seeds inside
yeah,
the fruit.
Yeah, really, really wild stuff. So anyway, I would pick that up. Styria is Styria. Email mark at restaurantguysradio.com if you have any questions about it, and we'll help you find some. So I hope that you look it up. It's great for the holidays. We'll be back in just a few minutes talking about the farm bill here in the United States with a gentleman who knows more about it than most people, and most people don't know about it as much as they think. We'll be back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC, the time is 11:15. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest today is Tom Philpott. Tom is the co-founder and co-director of Maverick Farms in North Carolina. He's food editor for the Seattle-based Grist.org and writes the nation's only regular column on food politics called Victual Reality.
Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you, guys.
Tom, we asked you to come on the show because we realize that, you know, 99% of Americans don't understand the farm bill, though probably 97% of Americans have a strong opinion on it, which is mind-boggling. We probably understand it better than 99% of the population, and we don't really have it completely down. You seem to. Is that correct?
I think so.
All right. Well, you're a farmer. You write the nation's only weekly column on food politics. Tell us what the farm bill is. Why don't you give us a little? Why don't we start with the history of the farm bill? Why do we have a farm bill? Where did it start? What's the purpose?
Okay, well, the Farm Bill started in the early 1940s, and the reason that the whole reason for the Farm Bill was to help farmers manage supply, because we'd keep what kept happening until the early 40s was that farmers would periodically produce way too much. There'd be way too much grain on the market. The price would plummet. Farmers would go out of business and suffer. Or they'd have a bad year. There'd be a drought or something. There wouldn't be enough food, and prices would rise dramatically for consumers. And so the government in the early 40s decided to help farmers manage supply with the Farm Bill. And the way that it worked is that it would pay farmers not to produce on a certain amount of their land to keep supply down. And then when there were great years and farmers produce way too much grain, it would pay farmers to store the grain and take it off the market and keep the price up a little bit. But when a drought year came, like a bad year came, then it would take some of that grain stored and put it on the market and keep the price down. So it would kind of smooth out price swings, helping farmers when prices got too low and consumers when prices got too high.
Seems like a pretty good idea.
It was a pretty good idea, and it worked pretty well. But then a funny thing happened in the second half of the 20th century, around the time the Farm Bill started, and that is that farms started to get way more productive than ever. Farmers started using a lot more petrochemicals, artificial fertilizers, pesticides. Farm machines got bigger and more effective.
So this happens after World War II.
After World War II, farmers really started to – that farming technology sort of exploded. And farms, you know, a farm in the Midwest became basically between 1940 and about 2000, productivity in farms essentially doubled.
Okay.
A single acre in the Midwest is producing twice as much food as it was 40 years before.
So what does this do to the Farm Bill?
Well, so as all that grain comes on the market, it overwhelmed the Farm Bill's ability to help farmers control supply. And in the early 70s, the Nixon administration, for a variety of reasons, decided to stop trying to control supply and tell farmers to plant as much as possible. And what they did was they said, look, if you produce as much as possible, you plant hedgerow to hedgerow, you stop taking land out of production, and you flood the market with too much grain, we're going to do two things for you. One is that we're going to look for foreign markets for your goods. And the whole policy started, in fact, with the Russian grain sale in 1972. And the second thing we're going to do is if the price of grain falls below your production cost, then we'll pay you the difference. And that's really the birth of the subsidy system that we have in place right now.
So to recap, what started as the government would pay you not to farm a portion of your land, now the government's saying even though we don't need that grain, even though there's too much grain, if the price falls so low because there's a glut on the market, we'll pay you for it anyway. We'll make up the cost.
Right. And the winner in that case, and what happens in Farm Bill debates oftentimes, the farmers are the villain taking this welfare from the government. But the real winner in this case are the companies that are able to buy the cheap grain. If you're Archer Daniels Midland, which is the biggest corn buyer, or Cargill, number two corn buyer, this is a very good policy for you because what you've seen in this period since the 70s is steadily dropping grain prices, and that's meant profitability for those companies. And it's also been very good for companies that feed animals corn, the companies that run our industrial meat supply, like Smithfield and Tyson and those companies.
Well, and also
greatly.
And also this coincides with when sugar was replaced with high fructose corn syrup as the primary sweetener in our diet.
Almost to the day.
Right, exactly. That was a little bit different than the Farm Bill, but it was the same sort of politics at play. And so what you have now is a system where the government is paying farmers anywhere between $24-25 billion a year to produce these grains.
Well, and you know, there's a large debate. A lot of people say, well, why should we pay farmers not to produce? And I think there are some good reasons to pay farmers not to produce. The question is, why should we pay farmers to produce stuff that's not necessary and to have it come out cheaper than it would in the free market? And I think that's a very different question. And other governments take a different approach on how to support their farmers. We're going to talk a little bit about that in just a moment. 1450 WCTC, the time is 11:24.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries.
food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guy. We're talking with Tom Philpott, co-founder and director of Maverick Farms and editor of Grist.org, the nation's only regular column on food politics. We're talking about the Farm Bill. Now, in the state of the Farm Bill today, one of the criticisms that's often levied against it is that all the money goes to very few, very wealthy farmers. Is there validity to that criticism?
Oh, yes. It's very true. Something like the top 10% of farmers get 80% of the subsidies.
So
there's a lot of concentration.
So now there's a new farm bill up in 2007 that hopefully, you know, January 1st is going to be passed. What changes in that farm bill?
Actually, not a whole lot is changing in that farm bill right now. The House passed a version a couple months ago. It's now in the Senate. It's kind of not really clear what's going to happen to it in the Senate, but the House version is very much like the 2002 bill. The one sort of difference in the air is this whole boom in corn corn-based biofuel
ethanol.
Suddenly there's this huge boom in biofuel, and that's pushed the price of corn up, and that's going to lower the corn subsidies a little bit. But in the 2002 Farm Bill, the formulas are all the same.
But here's the question, Tom. Why are we, and we hear all the time, and, you know, it really strikes a chord in our view of America and who we are, and we feel we want to protect our family farms and keep our family farms. And I often hear people who lobby or argue on the floor of our Congress, of both houses of our Congress for the Farm Bill, about how we need to help America's farmers. And, you know, that sort of creates an image of, like, well, as America's farmer, you know, a family farm. Yet most of that money's going to large corporations that are already profitable, and the family farms are still at risk. Why aren't they getting the money?
It seems to me that every single small farmer we've ever had on the show has said, "Yeah, please get rid of the farm subsidies.
Yeah,
they're killing me."
Yeah. Why is that?
Not very many small farmers at all get a penny from the government. Like, for example, I'm on a 2.5 acre vegetable farm. We have a CSA and sell the farmers market in Western North Carolina. And we don't get a penny from the government, and I don't think anybody around us does. Basically, only four or five crops are subsidized heavily, and the rest. And if you're not farming one of those four or five crops, you're not subsidized.
Well,
so it's important to know that the money doesn't go straight to the corporations. It goes to the farmers. It goes to these huge-scale farms in the Midwest, mostly. And it serves to keep the price of grain down for the corporations, so it's an indirect subsidy to the corporations.
Well, it's a subsidy to the corporation, and it's not a subsidy to the family farmers. So, for instance, and that's a very different model from what Europe does, and I want to talk about subsidizing the crop as opposed to subsidizing the farmer, and which is the lesser, which one of those might be better for society overall after the news. We'll be back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC, the time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through RestaurantGuysRadio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Tom Philpott is a farmer. He's the founder and co-director of Maverick Farms in North Carolina. He's also the food editor for the Seattle-based Grist.org and writes the nation's only regular column on food politics. Today we're talking with him about the Farm Bill.
Tom, we need to talk about corn. We really, you know, because it's one of the most heavily subsidized crops in our country, and how that's affected our country and our choices for corn. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, the thing about corn is the most subsidized crop by far, by a factor of, more, of two or something. And corn is also the crop that puts most pollution in the environment that we grow, because corn is a very heavy feeder of nitrogen. It needs a lot of nitrogen.
Very intense crop. It's very hard on the land, and it takes a lot of resources
input,
to grow corn.
Right. And the other thing is that since it's been so overproduced, it's gotten super cheap. A bushel of corn until a couple of years ago was going for about $1.50. You can imagine 56 pounds of corn at $1.50, and that put this huge, you know, this huge amount of corn on the market, and corporations very, very handily figured out what to do with that incredible surplus. They intensified animal feeding in CAFOs, which is a huge environmental problem itself. They turned it into high fructose corn syrup, which made the price of the sweetener incredibly low, and became ubiquitous in soft drinks and processed foods. And suddenly, if you look in the average grocery store, something like half of products in a grocery store contain corn in some form or other. And it's given rise to this system where the cheapest food is the food that's worse, the absolute worst for you. And the best food, the food that's best for you, fruits and vegetables, can't compete on price.
Well, let's clarify that. What we're saying is the government does not subsidize your fruit farmer, your vegetable farmer, or your small family farmer.
And even in this new bill, there's very little money going towards that.
And it not only doesn't...
Some talk of it, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, it doesn't... the thing is a little sick here, because it doesn't only not support the... If you're going to support a crop, support crops that are good for us and better for the planet. But
right.
Sort of crop-based subsidies are really harmful in a lot of ways. And it is a direct subsidy to these large corporations who use corn to make our junk food, to make our junk food drinks, and
to feed our cattle,
and to make this ethanol. One of the things I always say about ethanol is like, well, yeah, it may be cheaper than gasoline, but only because the corn that's used to make the ethanol is subsidized by a factor of two. Now, if the corn were twice as expensive, the ethanol would be twice as expensive, and we'd and you know what? And the fact of the matter is, it really is twice as expensive. It's just that you, the taxpayer, are paying for the price of that ethanol. Are you
That's
paying
right.
for the
most
price of that corn?
Most of the problems associated with corn are off the balance sheets of these corporations, and it's on the balance sheets of the taxpayers and people who live in communities around CAFOs and people who live in the Gulf of Mexico, where every year a giant zone appears that kills all fish underneath it.
Tom, you need to tell our listeners what CAFOs are.
CAFOs are confined animal feeding operations. And a typical CAFO, like a single CAFO house in a place like Iowa or North Carolina, will house 2,500 pigs in incredibly tight quarters. They're covered, the pigs are stuffed together, and they're just producing manure, and they produce an incredible amount of manure.
If any of our listeners ever saw one of these, they would stop eating pork.
Immediately. If they ever smelled one, they would stop eating pork.
Well, except let's you know, we buy our pigs for our restaurant from small farmers in the area. If you went and saw that, you'd say, oh, a pig farm. You know, it's a very different
thing.
It's
a completely different operation. A small pig farm where the pigs are outside eating good food and good slop and pasture is a whole different story.
But confined animals...
Of course, those farmers don't get a penny from the government.
Right. The confined animal feeding operations, which feed their animals a lot of corn... they're being indirectly subsidized by the government. Now, how does this wind up in a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico?
Well, basically what happens is that all the farms in the Midwest, you've got all these CAFOs in Iowa producing all this manure, and then you've got all these farms dumping fertilizer onto the ground, and the manure and the fertilizer runs off into streams, and it ends up in the Mississippi, and it heads clear down to the Gulf of Mexico, and all this free nitrogen in the water feeds a bloom of algae. And the algae bloom actually ends up being the size of the state of New Jersey every year when it all accumulates. And it forms a dead zone in the ocean that kills all sea life under it. And if you think about it, communities all around the Gulf of Mexico have lived for generations off of fishing. And those communities are devastated by this dead zone. And if you step back for a second, we're sacrificing this cheap, plentiful, sustainable supply of protein, this seafood in the Gulf, for this expensive, filthy, dirty supply of protein in the Midwest in the form of these CAFOs. And it just does not make sense.
One of the things about those farm subsidies, and this is the part of this that Francis and I do understand, and we understand really well, is all the hidden costs that are the farm subsidies add to American lives. And you just mentioned one that I think most people would never even consider part of the farm subsidy is, well, all that waste product stops a whole area of fishing from being able to happen because we've killed off an area of the Gulf of Mexico.
Right.
Now, the question is, you know, and it's funny because I hear free market people all the time talk about who believe in an unbridled free market. And I think that I believe in a free market within certain constraints. But this is I hear those same people argue in favor of this farm bill sometimes. I don't understand that at all. This is not free market. This throws the free market completely off. But I will argue that I believe we should have farm subsidies in this country. I believe there's a social value to having farms, and there's a real security value to being able to produce our own food. Now, we can't all eat just corn, but if we could make sure that we have enough farms to feed ourselves with vegetables and responsibly raised animals, Europe, when they have farm subsidies, they subsidize European farmers to be able to stay on the land and grow what's best for that land. They don't subsidize a crop that gets sold to a big corporation. Do I have that right or not?
I think they do. I mean, the thing about farming is a very uncertain and difficult task, and there are lots of uncertainties, and you never know what's going to happen when you plant seeds, and there's all sorts of things that can happen between the planting of seeds and the crop. And societies have always banded together and figured out how to best do agriculture. And our society is no different in that. It just seems that our society has gone haywire. But I do believe in this era of globalization that if we completely took away subsidies, then I think that what you get in the Midwest is you get a long period of farmers of falling prices and farmers trying to produce more to make up for the falling prices. And so it wouldn't be... There are some people who argue that if we took away subsidies, everything would be fine. And I think that we'd still see at least for a long while, 10 or 15 years, lots of overproduction in the Midwest. What I would like to see instead of taking that $15 to $20 billion and dumping it in the Midwest in the form of these corn and soy subsidies is let's use that money to reinvest in local agriculture here in the United States. For example, in most areas of the United States, there's no slaughterhouse to take your sustainably raised pastured pig within 50, 75, 100 miles.
That's exactly right.
And as these big companies have consolidated the control of the market, companies like Smithfield, they've shut down these small slaughterhouses, dairy processing plants, vegetable canneries. All this infrastructure in the past 40 or 50 years has been dismantled in the United States.
And let me tell you how that affects you as the consumer, okay? And I'll tell you exactly how it affects Francis and me. If for any of these local farmers to slaughter, they can't slaughter 2, 3, 4 animals at a time.
And they can't slaughter on their own property.
They can only slaughter once or twice a year because they've got to take all their animals to one of these slaughterhouses, which may be 200 miles from their farm. And they can slaughter once a year, and then they have to freeze their meat, so they can't get top dollar for their meat because they're only freezing once a year if they want to sell to specialty outlets, specialty markets, and it's just made that process all the harder for them and made their profits that much lower.
Right, and more expensive for the consumer. One guy who I know figures that it adds about $1 a pound to his cost to do his grass-fed beef because he has to haul it so far away. If you're a consumer, you're having to pay that dollar a pound, and that's if you don't have the money, that's going to force you back to the grocery store to eat, you know, this disgusting feedlot beef.
And so, you know, there are parallels in our country, and I think there is a parallel to when some of the auto companies, I don't know if it was GM, but one of the auto companies was found guilty in a United States court because what it decided to do was to buy up throughout the country streetcar lines and rip up the tracks, even though they were profitable, to build demand for their market. Well, if you rip up the slaughterhouses, you're doing the same thing. You're pulling away the infrastructure so the little guy can't make it. Even if he figures out a way to get a market, to pay a couple of bucks more and keep his costs in line and work hard to make a sustainably raised pig or cow, he can't get it to you. And that's the great tragedy. Hey, we have to take a quick break, but we're going to come back and talk more with Tom Philpott, the editor of the nation's only regular column on food politics. We're going to talk more about the Farm Bill, which you need to know about. It's pending right now. 1450 WCTC, the time is 1146. I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by-the-glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work, until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years' experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Tom Philpott. He is a food editor for the Seattle-based Grist.org and writes the nation's only regular food column on food politics. We're talking about the Farm Bill that's before the legislature right now. We've talked about the history of it. We've talked about some of the ways that our Farm Bill is not working to the benefit of the nation or the farmers.
So is there anything good going into this Farm Bill as opposed to what happened in 2002, which was not a great Farm Bill for the farmer?
There's a couple of potential things that could happen in the Farm Bill that would be good. There's a couple of conservation measures.
So what should we be fighting for? Because let's face it, the Farm Bill is going to go through. What issues should we be fighting for to make sure they get put into this bill?
I think that there's a segment of the Farm Bill that's called Community Food Projects, and that's a pretty worthwhile aspect that's still alive.
Tell us about it.
It's always under attack, and it's always about to get defunded. And that is funding things in cities and also in rural areas that basically do what I was just talking about, help rebuild this infrastructure. Stuff like investing in farmers market infrastructure, you know, covered farmers markets that could work during a rainstorm and, you know, not get washed out. Helping communities reinvest in stuff like trucks to haul farm, small farmers goods around. Every little farm doesn't have to have a truck to burn up all this extra gas and all take on all this extra cost, but to have one refrigerated truck for the community, stuff like that. But all the good stuff is pretty much at the margin of the Farm Bill, and the real money is in the commodity title. And the other thing is that the commodity title is totally funded. Like, it's got these formulas. When the formulas kick in, the checks go out. Whereas most of the good stuff in the Farm Bill is they're kind of playing with funny money. Like, it's not really fun. And if they have to actually find funding for it down the road, that's one of the big problems going on right now.
So, I mean, are there any heroes and villains? Are there any people in the Congress doing the right thing or hoping to do the right thing? Are there any particular legislators you can point to that say, you know, this guy's fighting for a fair shake for the American farmer and the American consumer?
There are a couple of them. Most of them are pretty marginalized. Tom Harkin is the chair of the Senate Committee on Agriculture. He's doing a pretty good job given the politics that he's faced with, and he's pushing some of these conservation programs. But he doesn't have much power to really fight these big subsidies, I don't think. I don't think he has the votes for it.
Well, and the fact of the matter is, let's realize that since, you know, they sell you this, we have to subsidize the American farmer, and you're thinking Farmer John, And it's going to a guy in a suit who sits in a corporate office. And
who's making your Fruit Loops.
Who's making right. your Fruit Loops, you know, and the ripples throughout the economy. So you have the big farm lobby, the big industrial farm lobby. You have the big food company lobby. You have the ethanol lobby. You have the chemical company lobby, which makes a lot of money selling fertilizer to corn farmers and pesticides
sure.
to corn farmers. You have the genetic engineering lobby, because corn is mostly genetically engineered in this country.
Companies are the same company selling inputs and seeds.
And so there's a lot of disinformation out there, okay, and you need to be aware of it. But there's a huge amount of money in the lobbying for this farm bill to stay just this way.
That's right. And the thing that I find so sad is that I think the era of most people in the country thinking that this farm bill is going to help out family farmers is pretty much over. I mean, there's a lot of talk now in the popular press about the farm bill, and people are understanding it better and better. But there's no political traction, and that's because of all this money you're talking about. The money is what is holding back any kind of real reform. And so at this point, we have lots of people talking about it, but the politics have not caught up yet.
Well, and also,
because a single person is never going to donate as much money to the campaign of a politician as some of these other giant
companies.
Of course
not.
Well, and also,
millions and millions of dollars.
If you also look at how it's framed in the media, I mean, what are the commercials on television? Fruit Loops, Pop-Tarts, soda. You know, these are companies that all benefit, that are all many of whom are against welfare to individuals, but who are all taking a check for these big companies.
Tom, I want to ask you a question, because one of the points in this farm bill, changes in this farm bill, is they greatly reduce the maximum amount that anybody, and one of the arguments for this farm bill is they greatly reduce the amount of money that
can go to one person.
Can go to one concern.
Right.
How will that trickle through in a good way or a bad way?
Well, I mean, I think it's a positive thing. As I understand it, the House version of the bill didn't do that as much as some people were hoping. The limit wasn't as strict as most people are hoping. And, of course, any limit at all, if they can lower the limit at all, that'll make it a little bit better. But it won't affect very much about the farm bill. It won't affect the fact that there's way too much corn and soy and other stuff being produced, and it won't affect the fact that small farmers are struggling. That's one of those little adjustments at the margin.
Man, I'll tell you, well, Tom, you've really helped us to understand, and I hope you've helped our listening audience to understand a little bit more about the Farm Bill. If you want to find more about Tom's organization, you can go to maverickfarms.org. If you want to read him, you can go to bittergreensgazette.blogspot.com. We'll put that all up on our website. Thanks for being on the show, Tom.
Thank you very much, guys.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. We'll be back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC. Time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. Farm bill, way heavy. You know, I'll tell you, the thing about the small farmer is I never met harder working people than people who work on a family farm.
Mm-hmm.
Your dad had a farm when you were a kid, right?
He did. It was
a rock farm, wasn't it?
That's what it felt like.
You harvested a lot of rocks, I recall.
You know, every season I never could understand how the garden, and we farmed on basically an acre, how the garden could reappear in a field we had cleared of all the rocks. But basically the rocks keep working their way up through the soil, and every year there were just thousands of pounds of rocks.
I remember in John Wayne in The Quiet Man when he goes back to Ireland and mm-hmm. he's digging in the field of his family's cottage, and he says something like, you know, he's digging in the field and he says, "Now I understand why you got so many rock walls all over this country." and whenever I see that, I think of you moving rocks.
Oh,
as
you
a
15-year-old
should. Kid.
You know, we talked a little bit with to Tom about small farmers and keeping people on the farm. You know, we got a lot of people out there, even in this area right here. You know, Liz Hance, the president of Magyar Bank, she bought herself a couple of acres. She's farming it. She's trying to develop her land enough so she can produce enough that she can feed her family and maybe sell a little on the side. You know, Bruce Talon, another guy I know, has just purchased an old orchard
farm
that he's going to
mm-hmm.
try and bring back.
Mike
our friend
Baker,
Mike Baker's a lawyer, is trying to preserve 4 or 5 acres out in East Brunswick, and he's doing
he supplies us with a lot of vegetables
some
too.
Good things out there. There are a lot of people who are making that move to conserve 3, 4, 5 acres.
And their efforts wouldn't be possible if it weren't for you who listen to the show, paying attention and looking out for local foods as well. So we're all doing our part. It feels good to be a part of that community. Hey, I hope you've enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys at 1450 WCTC. It's 12 noon.